This is a University of Otago podcast.
It was at the beginning of the academic session 130 years ago in 1879 that the University of Otago moved from its first site in what became known as the Stock Exchange Building in Princes Street to its new stone building here by the Water of Leith on the Old Botanical Gardens. And Dr. Stewart, the Chancellor, said at the time that the Council liked to have the university with some architectural style. In 1917, by the way, there were 111 students, a total of 111 students, attending lectures in that year. In 1917, a new medical school building was opened over the road from Dunedin Hospital in Great King Street. And there were 573 students at the University of Otago in that year, close to its 50th jubilee. Over the next decades, the university followed what became known as the diagonal plan, and most university buildings were erected on the diagonal between those two poles. Of course, over time, the science area was developed on this side of the river, residential colleges were opened, and the university started to expand towards Logan Park. The last campus master plan at this university was developed in 1980, an event which I can remember quite vividly because it was my first year on the university staff. And in that year, the university was hoping to achieve for the first time a roll of 7,000 students. 3 decades later, we have 20,000 students, major campuses in Christchurch and Wellington, as well as a small campus in Invercargill. The university is much more research intensive, and of course approaches to teaching and learning are changing rapidly. Many universities are developed deliberately away from cities on sort of greenfield sites. In fact, the very word campus, which was first used in its modern sense at Princeton, evokes what's been described as the tradition of Anglo-American academic pastoralism. Otago was different. Like its parent Edinburgh and its parent Leiden and Geneva, this university was actually created by the city and the community, and it's always had a very close relationship with it. And while I fear from some letters to the ODT that there are some citizens who see the development of the university as a sort of cancer spreading through North Dunedin, I hope that most Dunedin citizens regard it as a lively and attractive feature of the urban environment. But clearly, in developing a new campus master plan, we need to think not just about the needs of the university for teaching and learning and research, but also for our relationship with the city of Dunedin and our impact and our interactions with the wider community. And so I think few people would disagree that after 30 years and an expansion from 7,000 students to 20,000, it's high time we had a new campus master plan. And I'm first going to call on Barry Mackay, our Director of Property Services, to say a few words about how we're going about this, and then I will introduce each of our two speakers. Barry.
Thank you, Vice-Chancellor, and welcome everybody here tonight. The Campus Master Plan, as the Vice-Chancellor pointed out, has been around since 1980, and that's not to say that it's a failure, because it has served the university remarkably well, but it is time for a new one. We went on an extensive search for a consultant team to produce a plan and settled on DEGW. And they are here for the first of their information gathering visits. The plan is that over the next, between now and February of next year, the plan will be developed, discussed, refined. I was going to say argued over. There will be robust discussion, and in February of next year it will be presented to Council for ratification. The Master Plan has, in my view, has three really important things about it. One, it tells a story about the university, about where it's come from, about its relationship to the city, its relationship to the environment. The second is that it looks at the organisation and layers the organisation over the buildings and over the environment. And then it gives us a framework for development 20, 30 years in advance. And hopefully it will last as long as the 1980 plan lasted. We may be a little smarter with this one. We will review it on a regular basis. That's the program. That's what we're trying to achieve. The reason for tonight's lecture is that we had available to us two experts in their field, and we thought rather than bore you with the campus master plan, we'd get them to talk about what's happening in the world, particularly in terms of teaching and learning and of urbanism and space. So that's a little introduction. It's quite an exciting time for the university, and I think most of you, or most will have an opportunity to contribute to this plan in some way. Thank you.
Thank you, Barry. Well, I'm not sure Barry mentioned that in order to produce this plan, the university has contracted a firm of international consultants called DEGW, and I must confess I've forgotten what DEGW stands for, so I hope the first speaker will elucidate that. But after calling for bids from a number of organisations, this very experienced group were chosen to lead our planning. And both of our speakers come from DEGW, and this session is going to finish at 7:30, at which time you're going to get biscuits and tea and coffee, I think. So each of the two speakers will speak for 20 minutes, and then there'll be 10 minutes for questions and discussion, if all goes well. And I've told the speakers I'm going to come and very subtly sit here after 20 minutes, because I'm sure there are many questions that you'll want to raise at the end. Now, the first speaker is Andrew Harrison, who is actually the Global Director on Research and Learning at DEGW, based in London. Although he's lived in England for some years, Andrew is actually a New Zealander, grew up in Christchurch, and is a graduate in psychology from the University of Canterbury. He's the currently directing the Space for Personalised Learning Research Study for the Department of Children, Schools and Family in the UK. Also, he's leading the brief and concept design for the next stage of the British Library, and also the design brief for the new Tanzania campus of the Aga Khan University. And Andrew is going to speak about learning to work, working to learn, design for educational transformation. Andrew.
Thank you very much. Brilliant. Thank you very much, Vice-Chancellor. I'm delighted to be back in Otago. And the last time I was here, I was sleeping on the floor of Selwyn College, visiting a dental student friend. So it's great to come back in a slightly different capacity, but to come back to a stunning campus and to really remember the experience of being here, visiting friends and the buildings that I saw then. What I'm going to talk about now is just some of the ideas and trends that we're seeing in university design and around the bigger notion of education and the impact of different forms of change on learning. But the context is we're in this incredibly exciting time, and I'm so privileged to be within design and architecture at this moment when there's a real feeling of paradigm shift, of questioning the relationship between process and space in all sorts of areas. So just as a bit of context, I'll just show you a few slides around how the workplace is changing in the light of the knowledge economy, of understanding how people want to use space in different ways. And what we're finding is even the definition of the word company or organization is up for grabs. And when we look at companies, more and more we're finding networks of individuals working in different ways and occupying space for different periods of time. So you see that companies, in the same way as universities, consist of some people who are core staff who stay there all the time, and then a whole range of networks of people coming in and out. And that leads to different ways of thinking about space. You know, you don't necessarily need to have space all the time. And what we found is that many office-based organizations only utilize their buildings for 35% of the time. So many companies are trying to think about how they use physical space and how they use virtual space in different ways to provide more effective workplace solutions. And the big transition we're seeing is breaking down the boundaries of the office building. The office building no longer contains the organization. We're looking at distributed working, of using all sorts of spaces, including hotels, airports, trains, coffee shops. Those are all parts of the of our global network of workspaces. So the sort of soundbite phrase of what's happening in the corporate world is a transition from office as the city, where you try and cram every activity into one type of space, to a transition to what we call city as the office, where many organizations now use a whole network of spaces, of places within the city for different functions at different times. So it's a much more fluid arrangement of space and process. And that has implications both in financial terms, but also IT and management terms. And just to show you an image of where the office building is going, these are some images of BBC's latest office building, BBC Worldwide in London, which is a conventional office building in terms of the amount of space that they use and the activities that they do. But actually what you find is that it's a collegiate organization. They've taken on board many of the characteristics of the university about knowledge sharing, about face-to-face discourse, about interaction, and that's actually changing the way that they do their work. And I think there are some lessons from the corporate workplace that we can think about when we're thinking about education. So the big question that I spend most of my time exploring in the UK and elsewhere is, you know, we're at this time of paradigm shift. Are we also seeing paradigm shift in the way that learning takes place? Or are we still continuing the old models, very traditional models that haven't fundamentally changed for hundreds of years? And it's a fairly obvious answer to that question. Actually, we're in just as much a radical period of change in terms of how learning takes place in all parts of society as we are in the workplace. You know, the internet has fundamentally changed how work happens and how learning happens in all sorts of different ways. And I find it hard to remember now how I functioned as a commercial director of research without having, you know, anytime, anywhere access to the internet. Methods of learning and teaching are changing as we understand cognition and the way that groups and individuals learn. The population is changing. One of the things that intrigues me is there's still, in the UK, the notion of the student as a type, and actually that doesn't exist anymore, that we're dealing with a very complex mix of cultures, of expectations, of ideas, and we need to create a learning experience that supports that rather than constrains it. The most exciting thing for me, though, is we're seeing this blurring between living, learning, and working, which means that actually you can't define the boundaries of the university, the school, in the same way that you could a few years ago. And actually what's driving this is the changing expectations of students. There's a lot of conversation and a lot of debate about, well, what does the next gen student need? You know, what are these Web 2 things that we're talking about all the time? How does that change the way we interact and how we learn? But we haven't even got a clue yet, I don't think, moving forward about the next generation of neo-millennials is one way of describing them. The other phrase we hear used quite a lot is digital natives. You know, the generation that were born using the internet, basically. What will their expectations of the learning experience be at school, at college, at university? These are huge debates that we have to have, and they have a huge implication for projects such as the one we're embarking on here, where we're developing a master plan for 10, 15, 25 years worth of future development. We can't do it in isolation of conversations about who will be the future learner at the university. What we're seeing, though, already are some pretty clear trends about different ways of learning, about different ways of using the university estate or the school. There's much more emphasis throughout education on collaboration, about moving from passive to active learning, with much more hands-on, real-life learning experiences. The boundaries between departments are breaking down, and we're seeing much more interest and belief in interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary learning, of also blending where learning takes place, the notion of the school or the university as container is breaking down. So how do you support learning wherever people want to learn? And how do you use the power of the information technology that we have around us now to change the learning experience, to make it more immersive, to make it richer, bringing digital and physical resources together in new and exciting ways to enrich the learning experience? In the UK, we have this huge imperative that we need to really think through in terms of the future university. And it comes from the schools. This is where we're seeing a lot of the innovation being driven in the UK, is that we've got something called Building Schools for the Future, which is somewhere between 60 billion and 100 billion pounds worth of investment in schools. We're rebuilding every school in the country, one every 3 days for the next 15 years. But we're 400 schools behind already, so we've got a bit of a problem to catch up on there. But anyway, we're going to spend a lot of money on a lot of schools. It's every primary school, every secondary school is being transformed. But the great thing is, it's not about buildings. It's an educational transformation program where we're fundamentally thinking about the learning process and how that learning process is grounded in space. That's hugely ambitious, and we won't meet all of our objectives. But if we even get it half right, we're going to have a new generation of children coming out of school in 8 years' time with a completely different set of expectations about the use of space, time, and technology and learning. And they're not going to sit still for Economics 101 as a traditional lecture. They'll expect a different range of learning experiences and to be in control of their learning processes. So when I'm talking to universities in the UK, my big message is you have 8 years to sort yourselves out, to think about how you're going to deliver learning to meet the needs of your future students. And I've been having some conversations over the last 2 days here about changes to the New Zealand school curriculum and potential impact that that will have over time. So I think it's a really key issue that the learnings that we have in school will have an impact on the university education. So the big questions we're grappling with in the UK is, what is a school? What is a school in the 21st century? And actually, we have no idea. And even the people commissioning all these schools have put their hands up and said, I'm really sorry, we've had to commission these because we've got a program to meet, but we don't know what a school will be in 5 years' time, in 10 years' time, but we've got to keep on going. So, really interesting issues. And how do you get the value out of that investment? And one of the huge policy changes that's happened is that the government has announced that schools are not for children. Schools are for everyone in the community. It's a learning resource for the whole community. So I'm very interested to see blurring between school and other forms of learning. It's a community resource. And that's partly driven by the fact that someone has finally realized that schools tend to burn down when they're empty. So the more you can fill them up with activity and people over extended periods, the better the chances that it won't get burnt down by arsonists. So that's a slightly cynical view of the future of education, but it's really about extended use of blurring schools into the community. The other thing that's happened in the UK is that the schools are no longer responsible just for education. Their remit is the total well-being of children. So again, you're seeing changing roles between the school and society, which will have an impact in the future. So what, having come through this really rich learning background, this welfare enriched background, what will students expect from the university experience in terms of space, the use of time, and technology? HE is an incredibly important, higher education is an incredibly important part of the UK economy, and certainly everything I've heard, the Dunedin economy as well. So how do we think about the relationship between the universities, higher education, and society in different ways? And what is the experience that students want? There's an annual survey in the UK, of National Student Survey, where every student is asked what they think of their lecturer, their course, their university. And it actually causes a bit of a chill wind down many vice-chancellors' necks in the UK when you look at the results and find that every year the best quality, best rated courses are from the Open University, which is the one university in the UK where you don't actually ever go on campus. They have no campus. It's a distance learning experience. And yet it's rated the best quality learning experience. What's that about? That's about different sets of expectations, about really challenging the value of the physical environment. If you can get such a high quality learning experience, what is the role of the physical campus in the 21st century? Now, I can answer that question quite easily, thankfully, and I'm very passionate about the future of the university experience, but what the Open University is about a different set of learning expectations. It's about 180,000 people trying to fit learning into a very complex set of lives and life experiences, working at the same time as learning, living all parts of the world. So this provides a different route through learning. And I think we need to realize, again, that the student isn't a single need, a single set of expectations about experience. and think about what they need and how we can support their requirements. We're finding in the UK now that 55% of students are over the age of 21, having a different set of needs, different set of expectations, working at the same time, and coming out of university with a significant debt. So actually, we're finding there's much more focus on working and learning together. And one of the unfortunate victims of this is we have a huge problem with students' unions going bust across the UK because it's not about cheap beer anymore. You know, that was always the driver for funding students' unions. Doesn't work. So we're actually having to find different ways of providing social and pastoral care for students. So some people predict doom and gloom for the university campus. Peter Drucker in 1997 was even saying that, you know, the university campus is not sustainable. It's as financially untenable as healthcare in the United States. And he was predicting that the university campus will not survive for very much longer, that it was a dinosaur. Well, you'll be pleased to know we don't subscribe to that view, but we do believe very strongly that we're seeing quite a radical shift in the role of space on the university campus and the types of activities that take place. That traditional categories of space on the university campus are becoming a bit less meaningful, that actually we're seeing space become less specialized in a drive to try and make it more heavily utilized. I talked about higher office utilization at about 35%, which from a commercial point of view is appalling. In the UK, the typical utilization of an academic campus, formal teaching space, is between 18 and 21%. And specialized science spaces are down at 8 to 10%. So 90% of specialized spaces tend to be unused on a typical day for parts of the day. So actually, the notion of trying to transform the spaces into more flexible, adaptable, usable spaces has both learning drivers and financial and economic ones. What we tend to try and help our clients use is to think about the estate in a more holistic way. Because actually, the notion of utilization of formal teaching spaces is just part of a much bigger question about how do you make every square meter of your estate contribute towards the learning and teaching experience in some ways. You know, on a typical university, 40% of the space on your campus is the corridors and balance space, the bits in between, which are typically not expected to deliver anything from a learning and teaching point of view. But actually, if you take a learning landscape point of view and start to think about how all these spaces join together and how every space can be an opportunity for learning, for telling stories, to expressing values and ideas, you can start to develop a different spatial model for your campus. Another way of splitting the space up is to perhaps think about the specialized learning spaces and reduce those to a minimum to do the things that they need to do, but actually move more and more space into more generic multi-purpose spaces. And we're seeing that happening in a whole range of different areas, from the specialized laboratory type spaces, where how do you use those better, through to fine art studios and workshops and all of these places. How do you allow more people to use the same resource within a timetabled system? The other big change is happening is the realization that actually the informal spaces have played just as big a part in the overall learning experience than the formal ones. So the notion of the, you know, the cafes, the drop-in spaces, the lounges, some of which I have seen absolutely world-class examples here, which have already been photographed and will be in, you know, next week's slide presentation in Tanzania. You know, you're doing it brilliantly well in that area, but it's actually can be integrated into the curriculum and to the learning and teaching approach much more fundamentally. So just very quickly, some of the key themes we're seeing around the world is supporting mobility, allowing people to learn anywhere, anytime. Ironically, the big limiter for this at the moment is power sockets. You know, you can always watch the sort of furtive glance when people come into a room in a university to, you know, identify where the sockets are. Those are the prime pieces of real estate, and then it goes out from there. So we need to support people to learn how they want to learn and where they want to learn. I think there's a very key issue about community and neighborhood, and that's been a really key theme of the conversations we've had throughout the university for the last couple of days, is about collegiality and community. And how do you create spaces of different sizes, of different characters, to support community building, I think is an incredibly key theme. Exploiting transitions, this notion that you have 30 or 40% of your estate, which is just joining up the other spaces. How do you use that to celebrate ideas and values? This is one of my favorite learning technologies on the right-hand side, which is the Starter Center at MIT, which is a maths building. All they've done is line the walls with blackboards and put chalk out, which celebrates the notion of face-to-face discourse and problem-solving, and actually becomes a learning space throughout the day. So how do you, take advantage of every opportunity for learning? And some of that's about crossroads and destinations and the link spaces. And again, you have some splendid examples here of using the bits in between to create different learning experiences. And then there's food. One of the big cultural indicators I use to understand a university is to find out whether they allow coffee inside the library, which to me reflects a transition from a teacher-centered to a learner-centric approach, that it's starting to recognize the need that that's how people want to use space, want to blend learning and eating and socializing in different ways. And so, understand we are a grazing society and learning is part of that, key issues. So it's about blending spaces to support a whole range of different activities. And that's both inside and outside, to look at every opportunity for learning. And again, you have climatic issues here, but there are still opportunities during parts of the year which should be exploited and celebrated. But I think the other thing that I think is a risk is we're seeing this huge trend in many universities to create really buzzy, social, networky spaces, which is what people want some of the time. And I think one of the key things going forward is to also realize that learning and the university's experience is about contemplation, it's about reflection, it's about individual journeys as well as collective journeys. So, as we go through the master planning process, it's, well, where are the sanctuaries? Where are the places people can go to be quiet, to reflect? So thinking about the whole landscape as being a range of different types of experience. And I think there's the realization and a lot of exploration around how technology can support this much richer landscape. And I would say that at the same time that we're planning a physical landscape, it's imperative that a virtual landscape is planned as well, to look at the spread of technology, the range of technology work settings, and how that supports the learning process. And it's not about spending lots of money everywhere, it's about understanding the relationship between curriculum, pedagogy, and the technology and the space. So what we're seeing is, as universities, is really looking at a much richer range of learning settings. Some of it's immersive, spaces where you go inside your data, inside your images, to explore it using haptics and all sorts of different technologies, augmented reality, visualization. Things like health sciences is absolutely at the vanguard of these sorts of spaces. But what's really exciting is that across the world, humanities is in there just as richly. There's Project Bamboo, which is 170 universities exploring digital infrastructures for humanities, to really think about how you can use the digital world to explore a wide range of different subjects. But to whiz quickly along, because I'm aware of, I have this feeling that my 20 minutes he hasn't got out of his seat yet, but I could see he's edging towards it. Is that learning doesn't just stop at the end of the classic university experience. And we're doing quite a lot of work looking at lifelong learning. The realization, as I'm sure many of you are aware, is that learning is a continuous process. It's about renewal of skills. It's about careers transformation. It's about coming back into a community for a period of time. What's really exciting is this carries on all the way through life. And I'm delighted to report that the oldest graduate of computing studies for further education in the UK is 103, which is pretty impressive. But actually, there's a large percentage of the population is increasingly engaging in learning right through life into retirement. And one of my research interests is actually university-linked retirement communities. There are more than 60 universities in the US that have retirement communities on campus. So academics can just keep on going and actually live there forever, which might be a slightly scary prospect. But actually the great thing is, and the purpose of this is to bring alumni back onto campus with a whole set of life skills to offer back into the community, to mentor students, to actually become part of the community again. and because this is America, and then leave money to the university at the end. But I think it's incredibly exciting about this notion of age, you know, all age learning. I think moving away from this notion of bounded innovation in schools and colleges and universities to start to think about what I call learning-centered communities. You know, the university retirement communities are exclusive, gated communities. I think there's some exciting work to be done to define what a learning community is. If you take learning at the center of the community, how could you blend primary school education, secondary school education, colleges, vocational, higher education, lifelong learning, all into a place and an experience? And you know, in my view, based on our limited experience here in the last few days, because of your geographic circumstance and your position of, in the center of the city, I think you have an amazing opportunity to create one of the world's great learning-centered communities here with you as the University of Otago playing a major role. And I think that's an incredibly exciting challenge to move forward. So just moving forward, you know, some of the big issues that I still think need to be addressed, and I think it's probably issues that need to be addressed in every country, is much wider engagement on the implications of educational change on social and urban change. That actually we in the UK have not thought through the implications of educational transformation on the future workplace, of the relationship between education and social welfare, on the role of the family, the parents' responsibilities. All of those issues are big question marks for us. And I think there's some really exciting and challenging social debates to be held to think about the future role of education. I think in the level of school, you know, as I've spoken about, schools, I think, will transition into a much wider range. Last slide, I promise. And I think, you know, universities will be, you know, absolutely at the heart of the debate, at the heart of the solution as well. So I look forward through this master planning process of exploring some of these issues in a lot more detail. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Andrew. And I'm sure there will be some questions or comments, and I'd ask you just to hold those until after the second presentation. Our second speaker is Stephen Smith, and he's the Director of Architecture and Urbanism with DEGW. I must say, I'd really want to hear a definition of urbanism. It sounds like it's interesting, like fundamentalism or something. But Stephen has extensive international experience in architecture, projects across Europe and Asia. His recent master planning work for universities included the unification of the University of Manchester and UMIST, the University of Manchester Institute of Science and Technology, to produce one of the largest universities in Europe, with the Vice-Chancellor. I went from Melbourne, I recall. And he has a particular interest in the relationship of work and learning environments within the city. And Stephen is going to talk about Somewhere in Nowhere, the role of place in a hyper-connected world. Stephen Smith.
Thanks very much. Well, question one, what does DEGW stand for? It stands for Duffy, Ely, Gifoni, Worthington. So that's why we shortened it. They were the four founding gentlemen, mostly retired now. Andrew has, you know, given you the big picture. I want to sort of drill into one issue. I want to talk about this issue of a sense of place. In our discussions of the last few days, this word, a sense of place, has come up time and again, and it always does with master planning. It's about how we identify with localities. And it strikes me that rather in the similar way that Andrew is perceiving a great deal of stress and change taking place in the world, I think this issue of a sense of place, how we identify ourselves with localities, is undergoing some quite strange changes. So I want to talk a little bit about trying to define it, the forces of change, exploring the impacts, and perhaps edge tentatively towards some sort of a conclusion. Professor Alexander at LSE has been doing a lot of work on trying to make robots have a sense of place. Because what he, in his five axioms of consciousness, what he said was that a sense of place feeling that we're part of an out there world and with the ability to locate ourselves within it is absolutely fundamental to our sense of consciousness. And any of you who work in any areas of things like dementia, for example, in the medical sciences, one of the very early signs of that terrible disease is that patients lose that ability to locate themselves in the and out there world. And it's unbelievably debilitating. So it's both a medical phenomenon and it's also a cultural phenomenon. And it's under stress for a number of different reasons. I think one of them is to do with mobility, that we live in this kind of one-day world. You can't just about get from anywhere on the planet to anywhere on the planet in one day. And this very famous map by Buckminster Fuller from the early 1920s, his One City Air Ocean World Map, was an attempt to visualize this idea of a unified world, a one island in one ocean sort of view of the world, which we can crisscross across. So mobility is one thing that's straining our relationship with our sense of place. And the network, the interconnected world, this diagram of how of the traffic on the internet, how it jumps between different places. The interconnected, networked world is again disrupting our relationships with physical place. And time as well, the fact that we live in an interconnected world and we have to, and we communicate across it. And one of the very lucky strokes of being in London is that we occupy the time zone in the red bit. And if you get up very early and you go to bed fairly late, you can just about speak to everybody on the planet. I think that's partly because we fiddled it by inventing Greenwich Mean Time. But it's quite a useful thing. But technology is interfering with that geographical advantage as well, because of course we can now technologically time shift, we can leave messages, the internet takes away that geographical advantage that we in London used to enjoy. Now, these changes are all very desirable for us all. For all of us moderns who want to get on in life, who want to be international, to go to wonderful universities, to travel the planet and shake off our rootedness in place to be successful, this is somewhat curious to people who have names like the Prince of Wales. These are people whose very name, very understanding of things is about being rooted in place and deriving their power from it. We ordinary Joe Soaps, by contrast, actually derive our power by getting rid of our location in place to travel the world, to become educated, to get away from marrying the girl next door and doing what your dad did. So it causes some strain. And I find this diagram quite useful, which is the idea that we perhaps now occupy this blobby area of ambiguity at the cross-axis of somewhere and nowhere, and anywhere and elsewhere. And what I want to do is just unpack those four terms, somewhere, nowhere, everywhere, anywhere, and elsewhere, and just describe what they are like. Somewhere, of course, is vernacular place. This is Avebury in England. The people who made Avebury, these wonderful stones, these wonderful ditches, over a 2,000-year period, you can guarantee that those people, though we don't know them, their belief system, their culture, their faith, the way in which they understood the world was absolutely rooted in a location. And whilst I don't know much about Maori culture, I would imagine that sort of vernacular culture was very much absolutely from the soil. There's a wonderful, the Malay people talk about the Bumiputra, the man who comes from the earth. This is vernacular space. It was a relationship to place which is largely, which we now as moderns really don't have. We can re-inhabit somewhere. This is Chichester in England. Beautiful vernacular place. A place made out of the stone from the ground around. centred on the church, centred on the farm. We can re-inhabit somewheres, but we can't really authentically make them. The reason being that, of course, the people who made that sort of vernacular architecture were rooted in the soil. Their belief systems, their way of life was rooted in that place. Whereas for us to do it, it's a kind of a fake. We can't quite do it. And people have tried to do it, and a number have in England, tried to build modern vernacular villages. Somehow it just looks fake. It simply doesn't have the ring of truth. And I think along with this thing about somewhere, this issue about community. Community, I think, used to, and a lot of politicians still think it does, it's nostalgia. It's where beer was best, where people knew their next-door neighbours, didn't get out much, and lived this lovely life. But of course, now we're shifting actually much more to communities of interest. Two at the top, the Hell's Angels and the Hay Book Festival. You know, placeless communities of interest is much more to do with our modern condition, it seems to me. Let's look at nowhere. Nowhere, in my view, is a condition of place which is created by mobility. And it is very confusing to vernacular man. Vernacular man looking up at modernity, these placeless buildings in a mobile environment. It's things like air travel. It's about highways. It's about underground systems, which erode any relationship with place. It's sexy, though. It's desirable. We seek after it, but we sort of don't like its effects. Sort of extreme, total nowhere like this in Los Angeles. This is not an environment that's being created by mistake. This is an environment which is being created deliberately because of our pursuit of mobility to free ourselves from place, because that is successful for us. And in a very minor way here in Dunedin, you know, with a lot of the discussion today about the highway going through Dunedin, you can, although it's not very big, it's beginning to have that erosion of a sense of place because of the amount of mobility and movement on it. It's also about placeless success nowhere. If that postcard didn't say Osaka at the top, I challenge anybody to have spotted it. But it is this sort of bland nowhere, ultra-flexible world is very, very economically important, and we do, in a way, pursue it. We even make jokes about it, send postcards, you know, where are you? And inside the workplace, you know, we're constantly on the edge of two poles. One, the desire for the ultimate, tidy, Mesian, pure, ice-cold, air-conditioned, beautiful, paperless office, as a sort of symbol of efficiency and brilliance of that sort, or will self the author's office, you know, which is about where it is all about him and his obsessions and his scruffiness and his madness just stuck over the wall. In other words, this is somewhere culture located as opposed to nowhere. We choose. Between us, and I think in academic offices, you know, this issue comes up, doesn't it? You know, you academic guys love it. There are artists, of course, who are very interested in Carol Rhodes, but particularly making art out of this sort of nowhere environment, treating it as a culturally desirable thing to be explored through art everywhere. Everywhere is about branded environments. It's about the same thing everywhere. It's affecting particularly things like shopping, it's airport culture, it's the same food, same food everywhere. It's about, these happen to be different cities, but would you know? Well, you wouldn't, because it's about a homogenized, branded environment, which we desire, we pursue. They are very, very successful. To travel from here to anywhere else and going to a branded hotel is something that people are in pursuit of and want to do. It's about globalized branding. You go all the way to Vietnam and there's Coca-Cola again. And you see it, you see a collage of it when you go into places like this. This is Chek-Lapkok Airport by Norman Foster. Norman Foster has made a whole career out of being an absolute master, it seems to me, of creating air-conditioned nowheres, absolutely culturally devoid of any particular reference or meaning, which is fine, providing you only put in there branded environments. But then somebody comes along and wants to open a Chinese restaurant, and it's got cultural references, and you suddenly see this odd collage of somewhere in nowhere. Somebody trying to do something cultural in an environment which is supposed to be acultural and neutral. And again, artists such as Mariko Mori here playing with this idea about the brand itself, the idea of turning themselves into a branded robot elsewhere. Elsewhere is about this increasing phenomenon of being in one place but being connected to another place. So being physically in this room but on the phone to somebody else over there. Or being in one room and broadcasting messages to somebody somewhere else. So again, it's about the internet. It's about technology driving a sense of always being somewhere else. About in it constantly being a sense in a state of mind of distraction from this locality because you're thinking and connected to another locality. And I think the rash desire for huge numbers of icons, which seems to be a plague of architecture at the moment, is very much part of this. In a placeless world, the one thing you need to do is for somebody to remember you. And I think the desire for icons, 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 icons is a desire to be remembered in a bland and placeless world. And in London, it went berserk. They all got nicknames: the walkie-talkie, the spike, the cheese grater. They've all got names. I think the recessions killed them all off, however. Or even, in Las Vegas, where extreme elsewhere, where you simply gather together the icons of the world, cram them together, and make this is at one hotel in Las Vegas, where every icon you ever wanted, all in one place, all in one go. So there's a disruption of the sense of place. We cannot go back to the vernacular sense of place. We have to use a lot of these other types of place, which are to do with success, and in a way try and find new ways of mapping the world, perhaps in the way that Buckminster Fuller did here, to see New Zealand and the University of Otago not as a remote place at the end of something, but perhaps one of the great corners of the world, at the junction of the Southern Ocean coasts and the Pacific Rim, that it's actually as centered as anywhere else because technology is taking away the geographic advantages of places like London, but handing it very much to places which can provide attractive environments where people want to be. So some conclusions, yes, back on track. This idea, a sense of place is generated by the engagement of people with their locality. And this relationship is in a state of flux. Mobility and communications technology is changing our relationship with place. And we need to create new forms of engagement with place, which take on board these technologies. New types of worldviews, new types of world maps, a dance, sort of slightly poetically, a dance between people, identity, and location. Thank you.